You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. For the rest of today's show, we'll hear from constitutional law scholar and University of Southern California law professor Erwin Chemerinsky, speaking recently at an event hosted by the Coalition for Civil Liberties. Chemerinsky warned that a number of threats exist that endanger our constitutionally guaranteed freedoms traditionally protected under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
The story starts early in American history, when the survival of the Republic was still in doubt. In 1798, Congress passed a law called the Alien and Sedition Act. The Alien and Sedition Act made it a federal crime to falsely criticize the government or government officials. If you think about it, given the date when it was passed, many of those who ratified the First Amendment in 1791 were in the Congress that passed this law. The law was used by the incumbent administration of John Adams to persecute his political enemies. Speech milder than the jokes that Jay Leno or David Letterman say on a nightly basis led to people being imprisoned. Thomas Jefferson ran for president in the year 1800, in part on a platform to pardon those who had been convicted under the Alien and Sedition Act. And one of the first things that Thomas Jefferson did as president was pardon those who had been convicted. The law was repealed. It was never declared unconstitutional. In 1964, the Supreme Court said it had been declared unconstitutional in the court of history. It's a wonderful metaphor, but it didn't do much for those who spent a few years in prison under a blatantly unconstitutional law. We often forget that during the Civil War, there was tremendous repression. Thousands of people were put in prison simply for criticizing the way the North was waging the Civil War. In fact, even leading newspaper editors were put in jail for nothing other than their speech activities. President Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, the legal procedure where people can go to court if they're being unconstitutionally held, even though nothing in the Constitution authorizes the president to do this. The Supreme Court later said that the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus by Lincoln was unconstitutional. Many historians have said that if Lincoln had not been martyred, history would have been much less kind to him, especially in his appraising what he had done with regard to civil rights and civil liberties. During World War I, Congress passed two statutes, one in 1917 and one in 1918, that essentially made criticism of the draft and the war illegal. If you've ever studied freedom of speech, you know the case United States versus Schenck. A man circulated a leaflet in which he argued that the draft, military conscription, was unconstitutional as involuntary servitude in violation of the 13th Amendment. There wasn't an iota of evidence that his leaflet had the slightest negative effect on military recruitment. Nonetheless, Schenck was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and the Supreme Court upheld that sentence. That's the case where Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said freedom of speech doesn't protect screaming fire in a crowded theater. And of course, that's true. What Schenck was doing was the antithesis of screaming fire in a crowded theater. Schenck was making a constitutional argument. He went to prison for it, and the Supreme Court upheld his imprisonment. You might be familiar, maybe more familiar, with another case decided at exactly the same time. It involved the socialist leader Eugene Debs. He gave a speech to an audience where he said, and I quote, "You are good for more than cannon fodder. There's more that I'd like to say to you, but I can't for fear that I'll go to prison." For just saying that, Debs was sentenced to 10 years in prison. The Supreme Court upheld his sentence. The Supreme Court, the Constitution, failed us. There's no evidence that we were made safer or winning the war was more likely because Schenck or Debs were put in prison. During World War II, 120,000 Japanese Americans were uprooted from their lifelong homes and placed in what President Franklin Roosevelt called concentration camps. Aliens and citizens, and 70,000 of these individuals were United States citizens. Adults and children were placed behind barbed wire. There is no evidence whatsoever that the internment of Japanese Americans made the country safer. Not one Japanese American was ever accused, indicted, or convicted of any crime against the country, such as espionage or spying or anything like it. Race alone determined who was free and who was to be housed in horse stalls. The infringement of civil liberties was enormous. Yet tragically, in 1944, in Korematsu versus the United States, the Supreme Court upheld this as constitutional. One more story before getting to the present. And that would be during the McCarthy era in the early 1950s. It's quite frightening now that a best-selling book on the New York Times and Los Angeles Times nonfiction list by Ann Coulter defends McCarthyism. She says that McCarthyism is much maligned, forgetting the lives of innocent people who were ruined for no reason whatsoever. Many have referred to the McCarthy era as the age of suspicion. For merely being suspected of being a communist was enough for a person to be put on a blacklist, to lose his or her job, sometimes to be imprisoned. The leading Supreme Court case of the era was a case called United States versus Dennis. It involved a group of individuals who got together to organize a study group, a reading group, for works of Karl Marx and Engels and Lenin. For just doing that, organizing a study group, they were convicted of the crime of conspiracy to advocate the overthrow of the United States government. Now notice, it wasn't that they were convicted for conspiring to overthrow the government. It's not that they were convicted of even advocating the overthrow of the government. Their crime, and this is what the indictment against them said, was conspiring to advocate the overthrow of the government by organizing to read some books that now are taught not only in colleges, but in high schools across the country. For this, they were sentenced to 20 years in prison, and the Supreme Court upheld their sentence. The Chief Justice of the United States, Fred Vinson, said, "When the evil is so grave as the overthrow of the government, there doesn't have to be any proof that what they're doing increases the likelihood of it happening. Merely reading books was enough to justify a 20-year sentence, and I've done nothing to caricature or misrepresent what the case was about." Only with this in mind can we talk about what's occurred since September 11th, 2001. Now, I want to be clear, I'm not an absolutist when it comes to freedom of speech or the Bill of Rights. I do believe that at times rights have to be sacrificed for the sake of security. But I believe that before we give up our constitutional birthright, we should be sure that it's necessary, that it really makes us safer. The history that I've just related, I believe, teaches us that government's very quick to take away our liberties. In each of these instances, we weren't made any safer. Another example of this secrecy. In September of 2001, the Chief Judge of the Immigration Courts, Michael Crappy, issued a memo providing for the blanket closure of immigration proceedings whenever the government wants them closed. Now, there's a long tradition of immigration hearings being open, but the Crappy memo says that whenever the government says to an immigration judge, "This might relate to terrorism in some way, I don't have to tell you how," automatically closed, no other arguments about it. A federal court of appeals in Detroit declared this unconstitutional. The case was called Detroit Free Press versus Ashcroft. Judge Damon Keith wrote the opinion for the court. It's an eloquent opinion. It's easily found through the web, and I encourage you to read it. Judge Keith talked about how democracy dies in secret, how sunlight is the disinfectant in our society. He said, if the government needs secrecy in a particular case, let them explain to the judge why the doors have to be closed to the press and the public. But blanket secrecy, he says, is unacceptable. And he explained that this is total secrecy. When the proceeding is closed, no one's allowed in but the person to be deported and maybe his or her lawyer. No friends, no family, no press. The case appears on no docket sheet. so nobody can know that it even occurred. Everyone who participates is under a gag order where they're punished by contempt if they even disclose the existence of the proceeding. Judge Keith said, such secrecy is inconsistent with the very spirit, to say nothing of the letter of the First Amendment. Unfortunately, the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, in a case called New Jersey Press versus Ashcroft, came to the opposite conclusion and said it didn't violate the Constitution, and the Supreme Court, a couple of months ago, denied review in that case. One more example of such secrecy, and here too I'll point to the Patriot Act. A number of years ago, Congress created a secret court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And what it said was that if the government had probable cause to believe that a person was gathering information for the purpose of helping foreign governments, foreign espionage, then a secret proceeding could be held, lower standards than usual could be met, and all sorts of additional powers would go to the court. And everything this court did would be in secret. Well, the Patriot Act tremendously expanded the authority of this secret court. It said, it doesn't have to be that the purpose of the government is to gather information, just a purpose is to gather information about foreign intelligence. A study was done, and in the first 260 requests made by the government to this court, 259 of the requests were granted. There was a challenge that was brought to the expansion of the authority of this court. It had a secret appeal held with regard to its authority. Only one side argued before the court, the United States government. It's a strange court where there's only one side present, and it's the government. It's a strange court where even the argument as to the authority of the court is done in secret. Not surprisingly, the court ruled in favor of its own authority. After this secret hearing and secret briefing, it said, we have this broad additional authority, including conduct secret proceedings. And a few months ago, the Supreme Court denied review of this secret court proceeding. Secrecy is increasing in an unprecedented way, and the Bush administration doesn't even tell us much of what it's doing. Here I want to focus in detail on the USA Patriot Act. It was briefly mentioned earlier how it was adopted, but I want to talk in a little bit more detail, because this too is either unprecedented or almost so. After September 11th, the Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, went before the House Judiciary Committee and presented a long list of proposals for ways in which law enforcement needed more authority to deal with terrorism. Now, in the car on the way over, my 20-year-old son who's here tonight said to me, how did they adopt it so quickly? How did they write it so fast? And I said, well, the reality is almost every provision in the Patriot Act had been proposed earlier and had been rejected. Most of them had been rejected, ironically, in 1996 by the Republican Congress as undue invasions of privacy, rebuffing proposals by the Clinton administration. Almost every bad law enforcement idea that had been around for decades got dusted off and put together in the Patriot Act. As I mentioned, Ashcroft spoke on a Monday to the House Judiciary Committee. Immediately, the National Rifle Association and the American Civil Liberties Union held a joint press conference in which they denounced the Ashcroft proposals. I don't know about you, but I can't think of many instances where the ACLU and the NRA hold joint press conferences. 2 days later, Ashcroft went before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He toned it down a bit, but essentially presented the same proposals. There were then secret negotiations between House of Representative members in the administration and senators in the administrations. No hearing was ever held in any committee of either House of Congress. Can you think of virtually any other major piece of legislation adopted without a single hearing in any House of Congress? Then there was a House version produced and a Senate version produced. The Senate version passed the Senate 99 to Russell Feingold. But think about it. Even liberal senators like Barbara Boxer voted in favor of this. And I blame not just her, but us. We didn't communicate to her our outrage at how this law was being adapted and what it said. And it passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives. There was a secret conference committee that reconciled the provisions, and so we got the Patriot Act. Well, I tell you some things about the Patriot Act that you may not know about. Let's start with the definition of terrorism in the Patriot Act, because the predicate for everything in the law to apply is how terrorism is defined. The Patriot Act says that terrorism is a violation of federal law which is done, quote, to intimidate or coerce the government or civilian populations. That's the exact words from the law. Isn't almost any crime to intimidate or coerce? Bank robbery becomes a terrorist act here because, of course, there's intimidation and coercion going on. I remember in college participating in anti-Vietnam War protests. We were naive, but we thought we were going to be intimidating or coercing the government and changing the course of what it was doing. If we had broken a window in a federal building, that would be an act of terrorism under the Patriot Act. It is an enormously broad definition. In fact, under the Patriot Act, any act to aid terrorist groups is deemed a violation of the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act has a provision that allows the government to monitor anybody's email addresses that they write to or receive from, or the websites they visit, by showing a court that it's, quote, relevant to a criminal investigation. The government doesn't have to prove probable cause. It doesn't even have to show the lesser standard of reasonable suspicion. It just has to show that it's relevant to a criminal investigation. And it doesn't have to be an investigation of that person. It could be any criminal investigation. And I have said to many audiences, you should assume that when you send an email, or receive an email, or use the web, that there's no confidentiality to that communication. The Patriot Act also says that the government has increased authority for so-called sneak and peek warrants. Ever since 1791, when the Fourth Amendment was adopted, if the government wants to search somebody's home, they have to generally knock and announce before they enter. And if nobody's home, they have to leave notice that they were there and an inventory of what they took. The Patriot Act says that this secret court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, can authorize sneak and peek warrants, where the police can go in, look around, and don't have to tell that they were ever there. Isn't that really the epitome of Big Brother that Orwell wrote about in 1984? Another example of what the Patriot Act does is the authority for so-called roving wiretap warrants. And my guess is this might be the one provision of the Patriot Act that most people have heard about. Because the Attorney General of the United States did a press conference and stood up with a lot of cell phones and said, we need authority for roving wiretaps. What does that mean? From 1791 up until now, whenever the government has wanted a search warrant, they've had to enumerate what would be searched. And ever since there was electronic eavesdropping, things like telephones, the government would have to list in its warrant every number that it wanted to listen into. Well, a roving wiretap warrant lets the government designate a person rather than a number. Think about it. If there was a roving wiretap for Erwin Chemerinsky, they could listen to every phone, the building where I work, every phone in my friends' houses, every phone in the stores where I shop, every phone now in this building. I debated an FBI agent about this, and he said, hey, you're right. With a roving wiretap, we can even listen to the payphones that a person regularly walks in front of. Does it make us safer? Well, think about it. The only way that the government can listen into a phone is they know that the person has that phone. By definition, the government can't listen to the phone until they know the individual has it. So all we need to do is add new numbers to existing warrants. When I've raised this argument in many debates, the response always is, well, it takes too long to add new numbers to existing warrants. Why don't we just create a more expeditious procedure for adding new numbers? Why do we need roving wiretaps? But the Patriot Act provides for that. A year ago January, the Attorney General of California, Bill Lockyer, proposed that the California legislature give state and local police authority for roving wiretaps. I testified against that, and I was thrilled when the District Attorney of Los Angeles, Steve Cooley, led the fight against Lockyer and said, we don't need roving wiretap authority. Let's just create a procedure for more expeditiously adding new numbers to existing warrants. And that bill was passed by the legislature last year. I think it's a far better solution than roving wiretaps. I've disclosed the threats to liberty since September 11th. I've undoubtedly left many things out. But I want to point to one other way in which the past is repeating itself. In all of the other instances that I began by discussing, those who criticized the government were labeled disloyal. And you can go back all the way to the time of the Alien and Sedition Act and see this over and again. And the same thing is happening now. You might remember in December of 2001, the Attorney General of the United States testified before a committee of Congress. And he said, and I quote, those who raise the specter and fear of lost liberties are giving aid and comfort to our enemy. He's saying, in other words, those like me, like us, who are criticizing what the government is doing, are committing acts of treason. When Senator Biden, in a speech, said that the government should tell us about the things that it's doing with regard to the war on terrorism, what it means for civil liberties, and how long it's going to go on, immediately Republicans denounced him for giving aid and comfort to the enemy, for being a traitor. When on the eve of the war of Iraq, the minority leader of the Senate, Senator Daschle, said, we need more questions answered by the administration. No less than the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Dennis Hastert, called him, in essence, a traitor for raising those questions. Dissent is never disloyal, something Edward R. Murrow told us in a century ago. The Justice Department has an inspector general who's responsible for gathering information about how the Justice Department is performing its duties. You might have read that a few months ago, the Inspector General of the Justice Department issued a chilling report about the violation of civil rights that occurred for detainees after September 11th. People being held for months without any legal basis. Detainees being physically and emotionally abused by the guards. And the spokeswoman for the United States Department of Justice, Barbara Comstock, responded by saying, we apologize for nothing that we have done to protect civil liberties. That's in response to a report issued by their own department. I believe, as I said in my introduction, that all of our civil liberties depend on what we do now. Now, there's many things that all of us have to do. First, we need to inform ourselves. And I think there are, at this point in our history, more opportunities to become informed than ever before. There are countless websites to describe for us the Patriot Act, and the even more chilling proposals for Patriot Act 2 that the Bush administration is developing. Second, we have the duty to inform the organizations and the groups that we're part of. Once we learn, we have to tell others. Each of you in this room, unquestionably, is a member of many other organizations. You need to go and give a speech to them, like the one that I'm delivering here tonight, and tell them of this risk. And third, we have to mobilize. Barbara Boxer is a liberal senator, but she voted for the Patriot Act. Adam Schiff, the congressman from this area, is a reasonably liberal congressman, but he helped negotiate and draft the Patriot Act. We've got to let them know we're not behind that. There has to be a voice for civil liberties, and we need to be it. We need to think of other ways to mobilize, using all of the means at our disposal to communicate. What's at issue here isn't a liberal or conservative matter. It's our rights. It's our constitutional birthright. It's the rights of our children. I conclude with two quotes from former Supreme Court justices. One is from the late Justice Robert Jackson, where he said, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And of course, that's right. We have to take the needed steps to fight terrorism, to protect our security. But as we consider Jackson's words, we need to also keep in mind the words of the late Justice Louis Brandeis. He said, the greatest threat to liberty will come from well-meaning people of zeal. He said, people born to liberty know to resist the tyranny of despots. He said, the insidious threat to liberty will come from those well-meaning people of zeal who have little understanding of what the Constitution is about. As I think about the leaders today in Washington, people like George Bush and John Ashcroft, I don't think that Louis Brandeis could have been any more accurate if he knew of them in terms of people of zeal with little understanding of what the Constitution is about.
Erwin Chemerinsky is a constitutional and public interest law scholar and a law professor at the University of Southern California. His speech before the Coalition for Civil Liberties was prepared for us by the LA Sound Posse. On a final note tonight, this is our last week of regular programming here at Peace Watch. We've thoroughly enjoyed producing this show over the past year, and we thank all of our listeners and supporters for their generous feedback and support, monetary and otherwise, which kept us going for so long. Our staff is entering planning and production for a brand new show with a broader focus to be launched November 3rd on most Pacifica stations and affiliates. Stay tuned for further information and broadcast times. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.